Your experience. So yeah, well, first thing I wanted to do was start up. We were talking about where I grew up, but were you born in Wildcatcham or?
Well, I was actually born in King Edward because I was mum's first, I grew up in Wildcatcham. So yeah. We were living on the farm. Mum's originally from Darkin, and dad's family are multi-generation in Wildcatcham. So both sides of the family farming, and my sister was actually born in the neighbouring town, but because I was mum's first, I think they chose to go to King Edward. But I am born and bred Wildcatcham and still have family out there, and it will always be home, although I've lived probably longer now in Northam and other places than I did as I was growing up.
So did you live right in town or a bit out of town?
No, we were 25 Ks out of town. So we were close enough to be on scheme water. Although if you went across to my grandparents' place where the family homestead, like the farming homestead was, where Nana and Pop lived, and a couple of my other dad's brothers, they were on rainwater. But we were in a transportable about 25 Ks out of town. Mum went back to school and taught when I was in about year five. Dad was an accountant by trade, but had grown up on the farm, and he'd come back after playing footy in Perth, and in 1978 they did a little bit of travel and then came back to the farm, and that's where we started.
Interesting. Yeah, I noticed that. I was doing my research on you, of course, and I saw that your dad played a few games for East Fremantle. I didn't realise he was a footy head.
So dad was, and all his brothers and my grandfather, all exceptional sportsmen. And we grew up with a very strong sporting community, and we had to participate in absolutely everything. Unfortunately, the skill and the sporting prowess of dad and his brothers, my uncles, did not get passed on to Mia. So I'm competitive in many ways, but not in terms of talent on field. But I love playing sport. And I love being a part of a team, and that was a really important part of my upbringing, was being involved in team sports. But dad was exceptional, held the PSA sprints from when he was at Wesley College until I was still in university. Like, he was a fast runner and a big boy, and played footy and cricket. And I still, to this day, I was talking to someone last night actually at the Forestville Cricket Club, and he said, I played cricket with your dad. He was a really nice bloke, and I love that. I love meeting people that knew dad, because he's not with us anymore.
Yeah, of course. No worries. So did you go to primary school there, or did you go?
Yeah. Wildcatcham Primary School, Wildcatcham District High School it was.
So what year did that go to?
Well, we went to year 10. It's a district high, so you go kindy through to year 10. But at the time, so the early 80s, or through the 80s, the district was really humming. And so we had kids that would come from Quarter, like there was a big bus that came from Quarter. We had all of the outlying towns that only had primary schools. They'd come into Wildcatcham. We had the district high school, the district hospital. And so we actually had enough kids to go into year 11 and 12. So it was a big school. Our class, there was 24. I mean, that sounds ridiculous, but that was one of the biggest classes that went through the school. We had a really big cohort, and it was a pretty typical country upbringing. Dad was on the PNC. Mum taught at the school in my later primary school years. We were heavily involved in everything that opened and shut, as many country community kids were.
Tends to be that way. The other thing is, I'm noticing all the politicians that I'm talking to, they tend to have a similar kind of background, being involved in a community from an early level.
Yeah, I think I don't know that I realised it at the time, but certainly as I've been asked to talk about myself in my political career, and as I reflect on it, you certainly look back and say, if you didn't get involved in towns like Wildcatcham, things just didn't happen. So you had to be involved. If you wanted the school to go well, you needed to be involved in the PNC. If you wanted an athletics club, well, you needed to actually be involved. If you wanted the footy club to go well, you had to be involved. And that's how Mum and Dad and all of our neighbours, our family, we were in St John's, they were at the RSL. My pop for a time was the Shire president, and my uncle has most recently been Shire president as well. It's just a get involved and give back community. You get out what you put in.
How do you bring that to the city?
I think there's definitely, I was in Forestfield last night at the cricket club. There is a very strong sense of community around that club. People actually contributing and being a part of something that's bigger than themselves. They have a great sense of history and of the people that helped build the club. So there's definitely pockets of that, and you just have to find your own community to be a part of. It's just not, I think it's an element of being in a small town is that everyone is involved in multiple different community groups, so there's not a lot of delineation, whereas yes. You can sort of choose your tribe in the city and be involved in sport or be involved in a community organisation. So that it definitely exists, and people have neighbourhoods that they feel very attached to and that they love being a part of.
Yeah. Well, it's not so bad up here in the hills, right? We kind of live in a bit of a bubble because we're the people who like country, but we want to be close to the city kind of thing. So I hear that. But when it was interesting when I interviewed Adam, so he said that, you know, because it was so much community up here, right, he actually wanted a taste of what it was like down there. And he moved down the hill and he said basically he knows the difference straight away.
Yeah. I think there's definitely a difference. There's no doubt about it. And a lot of the hills communities do remind me of the communities that I've been a part of or have represented for the last 16 odd years, you know, smaller towns, villages, there's a sense of identity, and as the hills as a collective as well, a sense of identity, whereas that is harder in some of those suburbs down the hill and in the Perth metropolitan area, but not impossible to find. But yeah, that's what makes the hills special.
Yeah. And well, I guess that kind of makes sense why the Nationals would start to move into this territory, because there is a bit of a crossover here, the seat of Bullwinkle. It's kind of half city, half country. It's a unique opportunity. And, you know, I was telling Lisa when she came on the pod, and I was saying, you know, because I don't vote major parties generally, right? Well, I voted Liberal way back, maybe John Howard. Ever since then, it's always independents or fishers and shooters or whatever. Just because I kind of tapped out of the two-party system. But when I first started doing it anyway, I noticed it was 3%. Then the next election, it was 5%. Then it was 7%. Then it was 10%. Then it was 20%. The last election, just under 30% of people. So what I'm saying is really your market is a growing market.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think the last 6 months since I've been pre-selected, and obviously Lisa has lived in Kalamunda in the hills for a long time. She grew up here. She spent a little bit of time in the wheat belt, came back, and she's been having that conversation with us for a long time, which is there's a synergy between the communities that we have traditionally represented, but also a growing sense that people are looking for the alternative to the two major parties. And we call it the Coles and Woolworths. Like, people are sick of the Coles and Woolworths.
Yes.
We're like your IGA or, your Foodworks or your Aldi. So we've got the established party structure, which I talked about being a part of a team. I love being a part of a team. Yeah. Being an independent is hard. Particularly in a political sense, because part of doing your job properly is being able to have open, honest conversations, not only with your community, but being able to thrash that out with like-minded people as a part of your organisation, and them keeping you honest as well, that you're a part of something bigger than yourself. But I do think once you get to that next level, the bigger organisations, maybe the ideology and the tribalism takes over, as opposed to the, what are we actually here doing this for? Why do we actually join the organisation? Why are we a part of this team? And I like that about the Nats. That's why I am a member of the Nats.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because actually should tell the listeners, so the first time I met you, I'm at my market stall. I see you walking up. I'm thinking, shit, here comes Mia. Say something smart. So I'm thinking, like, you know, what can I say? It's not going to make me sound like an idiot. And then I was like, really, the question I've always kind of like wanted to know is like, in a two-party system, why do we need a third party? And do you remember what you said?
Well, I hope I'm consistent. I do remember the conversation, because I've been having it a lot more since I've put my hand out for Bullwinkle, because it's something that I'm having to have a discussion across the board with people. Like, why would we vote for the Nat?
Yeah, well, what you said was about the ideology. You said because our party concentrates on policy, not ideology.
People and community and policy, not the ideology. Common sense.
The two parties have, you know, they've gotten away from that. And so actually, because what I wanted to do is talk to you about last weekend as well. Like, fuck, is all I say about that. I mean, we'll get into it.
I nearly said that on state TV live when I saw some of the results coming in, and I'm sitting there going, well, this is going to be an interesting night.
Look, it was weird because, like, it was kind of a surprise but kind of not. And like, I made my predictions and I wasn't that far off. The swing was on. What I found interesting is that the swing was going more towards you guys and the Greens than of the major parties. And, you know, talking to a lot of people, listening to a lot of political discussion about it, you know, I feel like that's kind of where the Libs, you know, have gotten away from it a little bit in terms of they've gotten back. Because if you go study the Libs, right, what they're about at the start, well, they're not that anymore, you know. And the other thing is I wanted to say is I noticed, so when I was standing in line, I mean, the whole thing was a complete schmozzle, but we won't go spend too much time on that. Yeah. I noticed, I reckon, because it took me about 40 minutes and I was there at 8 o'clock, it took me 40 minutes. I reckon I saw 20 people throw their ballots in the bin. Now, at the moment, the count's still going. Adam's only in the lead by like 100 votes. So those 20 votes, right? So then I looked up all the informal votes, right? 15%, 20% of people are throwing their votes away. Man, those people could decide who's in power.
It really blows my mind. And I get people are cynical and frustrated. And again, it's interesting coming down the hill and into the metro areas where there isn't a history of the Nats or people that have known me or maybe our organisation, because there is a seriously high level of cynicism. Now, that not to say it doesn't exist out in the bush, but I think people are genuinely engaged because when governments change from people that live very remote from the seat of power, it's the difference between actually having a service or not in terms of hospitals, schools, road infrastructure, those sorts of things. I think if you live in the Perth suburbs, and this is not universal because there's definitely challenges that need to be dealt with, but the bus is still going to go past. There will still be a hospital at the end of a suburb close by. Your school will still operate, but that is not the case. There is, in quite a number of the communities that I've represented for the last 16 years, not a doctor at some points in time. In quite a number of my communities, no doctor for some periods of time. And the shire councils and the local governments, you know, turn their minds to, how am I going to get a local doctor to come and live? So these are real fundamental problems. So politics means something in those communities. And I also have the discussion with people where we're a little bit like what we did when we first met, is you should expect more. You should expect more from your politicians. Like this base level of like, I'll turn up, give me a couple of dollars every election and then we'll bugger off and, you know, you'll never see us again. I'm like, that is not what representation is about. I'm expecting to be challenged. I'm expecting to be held to account. I come from an area where they have a very high bullshit meter. You said I could swear. I'm going to use it.
Yeah.
They have a high bullshit meter out there. Yeah. They don't let you get away that's with. Not right. That I would want to, but we should hold people that want to be in those real privileged positions, not privileged as in terms of money, but we make decisions that change people's lives potentially. So they should expect more of their local members and the political system, and then you want them engaged, not chucking their votes in the bin.
This is one of the things I'm constantly banging on about, you know, and I tell people, like, because often when I start talking politics, right, a lot of my friends glaze over. But I say to them, do you care about tax? Do you care about car rego, fishing licenses, hospitals, all this? Because if you do, and of what you say, if we could get more people engaged, I think we would get. But, yeah, I'm feeling like, talking to a lot of my friends, there's a lot of disillusion out there. But what I couldn't believe, me, is that one thing I'll say about the election, right, everybody agreed on the same thing, right? Shit's not that good, right? But you voted the same way again. Like it would have bought, I can say, right, honestly, it would have brought shivers up my spine if Liberals had a won by that margin. What we need, right, is a robust, balanced parliament. This whole, like, one side, and I don't care who it is, it's a bad idea.
I absolutely agree. And, you know, having come out of the state system and sat in that parliament for the last 4 years, where there's been an overwhelming majority in both houses of parliament, I can tell you that it does not work. And it doesn't work for a number of reasons, not just because we're sitting on the wrong side of the fence. It doesn't work because you don't have capacity to engage through your opposition portfolios. So there is a role for the shadow ministers to be, one, holding their opposite to account, yes, but also to be developing alternative policies that you can put forward during an election and maintaining and engaging with all of the stakeholders. There's no opportunity to go out and actually engage from a community perspective because you are such a small team, you're focusing on the things that must be done. The committee system doesn't work. Question time doesn't work. Legislation scrutiny doesn't work. And if you've got a really arrogant government, they will take advantage of the numbers and will push things through knowing that it wouldn't matter one iota what the opposition says. They don't have to care because they're going to get it through regardless. That's not how you'd like to think that people are making legislation. We had multiple pieces of legislation come back to our parliament, which is wasteful and time consuming, and the public servants involves, you know, like the time, the money, and the frustration, mind-blowing.
Yeah.
But it's process stuff that I think not lots of people see from a parliament perspective, and it just doesn't work. So the one great hope is that there is at least some more people in that state parliament, yeah, that are going to be able to do that job better. They need to do that.
And look, there was a bit of a swing, but what did you think of the whole thing last weekend, just generally?
So if I put it from a National Party perspective first, highest number of primary votes cast for the Nationals in the history of the party. So that tells me that there are people that liked what they saw with Shane Love and our team and our candidates, and that is a big part of it. We pick people that are local champions, that are good and decent people, already leaders in their community, and we put them into a system where we say, be yourself, but be a part of our team. And I think we were rewarded for that. More broadly, there was a really strong punishment towards the government in regional and outer metropolitan areas, where people do feel like they've been forgotten and there's too much focus on, you know, things that they don't think governments need to be meddling with or interfering with in people's lives. Like, let's just focus on the basics. Can I get a decent telephone signal? Have I got a decent, my cost of living things are starting to impact me. I think people really felt that in the bush and they rejected Labor. And as you say, they went elsewhere. They weren't necessarily going to the Libs as the other major party, but they were swinging away. And then it's a seat by seat. It was a bit of a seat by seat, and you heard lots of commentators saying lumpy. It was, because there was some really, I think there was some personal votes, like people that were not necessarily Labor votes, but they were strong local members that got rewarded and they're back in. There are others where Cottesloe scared the living daylights out of me.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm sitting on the Channel 7 panel and they had Cottesloe on the board, and then they said, we're actually going to take it off. And at that point I was like, oh, wowee, okay, we're in for a bumpy ride tonight.
I was like screaming at the panel because I saw you and Basil sitting on the end there, and I could see Basil even kind of like, I wouldn't say shell-shocked, but he was like trying to get as much data
as quickly
as possible. And yeah, they kept pulling it down. And then like for our seat as well, right, they never showed it till like over in 40 minutes, 50 minutes.
We weren't getting any data.
And then they didn't talk about it. But yeah, it was interesting what you said about seat by seat, because I like to go through these things because that's one of my hobbies, right? Call me sick or whatever. But I literally went through seat by seat, and because initially I said probably 10 for the Libs. And I got pretty close, because most of those that I missed, they're only like really small margins. But the swing was on. But what shocked me was, yeah, how far, because the Libs, I think, are still, you know, I think what happened too, right, is like they never provided like a real opposition, right? So if you're going to cross the floor and vote with the government on fucking gun laws, DEI, whatever, right, then you're not providing. And that's what a lot of my friends were saying to me. You know, whereas you guys, I saw, did provide an actual kind of like, okay, this is what we're going to do, this is what we're going to do. And look, you could probably argue you could have done more than that, but you could always work more, you know what I mean? But that's the difference that I saw, was that you kind of are now offering a real opposition. Is that how it feels?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think we were very clear about the firearms legislation, and that was certainly, we knew that was a big issue. And even So the Labor Party tried to characterise us as, you know, chasing a block of votes just for the votes. And we're like, well, actually, no, this aligns very closely to what the Nats have always done, which is, a lot of people don't understand firearm owners, but they are just everyday ordinary people, probably some of the most law-abiding people in our communities. They don't deserve to be criminalised by their own government, which is what they all of a sudden overnight were made to feel like. And yeah. That to me is fundamentally wrong. So whether you like guns, whether you agree that they should be around or not, I don't think any government has the right to make a section of our community who are doing nothing wrong feel like criminals, and to marginalise anyone. And it happened to be gun owners on this front. And I had many, you know, people that had been gun owners since they were 16 coming to me and just saying, I've never felt like this before. I don't understand what we've done to earn the ire of this government. And I said, mate, it's politics. They are chasing a vote. They're creating a problem to solve. In the last election, it was COVID, and they were saving the community from COVID. They needed to manufacture one for this election, and you became the target. And that is just so wrong. That is ideology over policy. And I can't get around that. And I think Shane articulated that as the leader of our party really well. And that's why we got support from a new cohort of people who probably didn't think about politics a lot beforehand. Wrong. Yeah.
And look,
you pick on me, I'm going to find someone that sounds like me, and they're going to go and have a fight for me. That's what we did.
Perfectly. Because to me, I had to explain it to a lot of my friends because they're like, what's going on? It's like, it's not about the guns, right? It's about the fact that these are law-abiding citizens and the government's just come along and rammed through, you know, like, Dr. Walker told me on the committee, they never saw anything, basically. You know, they never used the committee. They just rammed it through, and it was done without consultation to the public. And, you know, like, at the moment, right, I don't actually own a gun, so I've got no skin in the game.
Neither do I, by the way.
Yeah. Well,
but I'm very sympathetic to those that have been involved and had, either for work or for sporting purposes, club purposes, you know.
And what you said about people being the most responsible, right? So I got a few mates, right? And like back in the day, I wouldn't say we were wild, right? But, you know, the odd punch up in the pub and shit like this, right? Now, since those guys have bought guns, guess what? Yeah. And you know what? A couple of times I even heard one of them say, man, it's not worth losing your guns over.
Spot on. And that was one of the things that, you know, when we were having these discussions and people that maybe living in inner suburbs and they're saying, well, why does anyone really need this many guns? Or why do they need to own a gun at all? I said, you know, you're talking about somebody who probably has used firearms since they were 16. Young fellas who let loose at the pub when they're going through teenage and early 20s.
Yep.
These guys aren't, because they don't want to lose their license. Like, they are going to be some of your most law-abiding. And everybody I know, definitely the culture's changed from, you know, the 80s from the 80s back in the day, where a lot of farmers in particular probably didn't secure their firearms.
Yeah.
Those days are gone, and they still know how to manage it and use them, you know, use them properly. And the club stuff to me is also the bit that I find remarkable, because for a lot of people, that is they don't go to the footy, they don't go to the cricket, that is their club. And from a mental health perspective, from a belonging and feeling, all the things that you get told you're supposed to participate in, all of a sudden you're like, well, you're going to stop me from being able to do that. And we've lumped all of these firearm owners now onto a structure that cannot cope, because the clubs aren't ready for it, and there's no sensitivity about that at all from the government.
I think it's unfortunate, to be honest.
Completely. No, the cops don't have the resources. And the other conversation we were having, which people were really sensitised to, was that we have a significant increase in antisocial behaviour, crime in our communities, particularly in regional areas, and yet we've got the police focused on this policy idea, this thought bubble that the government thought they were going to use to create an upswell to get them back over the line, which they will now claim as a mandate. Watch this as this folds out. The mandate is there. Oh, look, people overwhelmingly voted to make sure that our position on guns is upheld. It'll be the first thing that they say. Papalia will be out there. And it's so disingenuous and galling, so disingenuous. But that's the politics that really gets right up my nose.
It makes me want to buy 5 guns.
Well, you know, I just think we just got to keep being smart. And that's the challenge. Whenever you are the group that is the minority that's being pulled aside and targeted, it's on, the onus is on that group to be better, smarter, more articulate, to defend something that is, you know, you shouldn't have to. So whether it's guns or whether it's another group, that kind of debate can come to you when the government of the day decides there's a vote to be won by chasing a Greens preference. I mean, look at the live export industry. That has come about exactly as a result of politics and ideology. It's no different. And it just gets up my nose. It's why I'm still involved in politics, Ira, to be honest, because I cannot stand people in those privileged positions playing with people's lives in a really unfair, it's unfair.
You are what we call a freedom fighter, right? So in my purple circle, let's call it right, and like we do a lot of research, we don't do woo, right? But you are what we call a freedom fighter because you're recognizing all these things that is wrong with our system and making a stand. And I find really what it all boils down to is education, because most people, once you explain it to them, but here's the million-dollar question, Mia, how do we do that?
You keep doing it. And if I've learned anything, if you are a sensible and civil and with common sense, you bring that voice to every debate, a silent majority will say, I actually like what you're, I like the way you conduct yourself, I like how you're presenting the argument. The other thing that I've learned, and there's been some pretty divisive debates in my time in politics, is that you have to be courteous to people that have an alternative view to you. And I'm not talking about the politicians. I mean, yes, there's a degree of robustness in our parliament. I'm talking about people in the community that maybe don't have the same level of information or background or support I have to build an argument. And to leave the door just slightly open, JFK used to say this, you know, former American president, lots of flaws, but, you know, was a man of his time, but was very clear about the fact that when you're having these big debates, you've got to leave the door just ajar a little bit for people to gracefully retreat and then come back to have the conversation again. And if you make someone feel like they're a dickhead or like they are stupid because they've got a different opinion, all they will do is walk back into their corner and get ready to punch on. And if you know that about people, don't set that debate up unless you really want to have it and you're confident of winning, right? Yeah. So
that is such good advice. It took me about 45 years to figure that out.
I'm 46. It's probably taken me a while too. But politics helps you hone that, I think, in that you are dealing with people, everyday people who have got a thousand other things on their mind, and then they've got a very strong view about something. And if it's not the same as yours, you can't just put them in a box and say, that's it, they're not our supporter, we'll never talk to them again, because they're still your constituent, they're still someone that you can learn from. I think too many politicians do politics by numbers, and leaders do politics by numbers, where you don't and aren't willing to have some of those harder conversations. And you miss out on so much. You miss out on so much.
I think that's why you've been able to stay around so long, right? Because really, in politics terms, you're kind of like a 400-game AFL player. Like, people have done that many terms, especially if you win the next one, like, you're going to go in the Hall of Fame, you know what I mean? And I think that's because I tell people, right, so that's such good advice, because, young Ira was like, fuck you, I don't care what you say, and I would yell and I would be aggressive, and then I just, like, you know, old age brings wisdom, and then, you know, I nearly died a couple of times, and that'll, you sort your shit out really quick after that. And then now I've sort of come to the point, right, where I tell people, right, you're never going to lose an argument with love and grace.
I think that's true. A little bit more of that in our political system, and, you know, you've got to, there's a balance. So people want to see a leader. They want to see that you're going to stand up for them when the chips are down, that you know going into these debates you're not always going to win, but you'll get a blood nose trying on their behalf, but that actually taking a tactic of including people and not the kumbaya, let's sit around and, you know, that sort of stuff. That's not what I'm talking about. It's actually just giving people space to have their opinion and disagree in an agreeable way.
Yeah.
And say, all right, well, we're not going to agree on that. But do you agree with me on 80% of everything else that we do? Is this your game changer? Because if it's your game changer, then you're not going to support me. That's fine. And that's okay. I'm still going to talk to you. I'm still going to come up and say hello. But I think people see disagreement or that oppositional nature of what we do, and they're like, oh, well, we disagree on that, so that's it, we can't be friends. God, this would be such a boring world if we all agreed.
I don't know what you reckon, but I think the world is slowly getting better, slowly changing, and people realising, like you said, we can disagree but still be friends. Because one of my main concerns what's going on in society at the moment is that I feel like the people that are the minorities, right, and let's say gun owners, but then I'll throw Greens in there as well, right, I feel like those people on the outer are kind of getting ignored.
Yeah, I also think that there's a level of extreme views that through the way the media works these days probably get a bigger portion of the pie than they used to. And so, I don't know, I just like to sort of sit in the middle. I understand the nature of having the Greens, and if you sit on the right side, there's the, sorry, I've got my left and my right wrong. You've got the That's Greens right. on the they left side. They can't way. See. The Greens on the left and One Nation and some of the right-wing parties, and you've got that sitting on the fringe, that makes you in the middle. It makes you consider your views and makes you actually hone your argument and make sure that you're speaking for the majority. But you should never ignore people that don't have a voice in the community. And I've been pretty careful, I hope, in my time about giving those who do feel remote from power, whether it's because you live regionally or your geography, or whether it's because you're a person living with a disability or you don't feel seen by the community, that you should have an avenue and a way of expressing yourself and be listened to.
How do we do that? Because I feel like a lot of people slip through the cracks.
Yeah, they do. But I think that's good. That's good government. To make sure that those that need help are supported, while making sure that you are looking after a majority of people that just need a clear playing field to get on and do what they want to do in life. So clear the regulatory burden for small businesses, because we know that if a small business can get on and do what they do best, they will create jobs, they'll add value to their community, they sponsor everything in your local community. Oh, hello. Got the motorbikes going past.
We live on the racetrack.
Sorry. That's well, right. Commentating to the people listening, we had some, it's Saturday morning and they're going past on the motorbikes having a Saturday morning ride. I think you just, to go back to, make sure you get the basic things right so that a majority of people can get on and do what they do well and look after their community and contribute and go back. But in the Nats, we've always understood that if you wholly rely on the market taking care of aged care, childcare, making sure that if you're making decisions around, well, we won't do that because there's not very many people up there, the cost benefit for taxpayers is not going to be great, that we would never spend any money on those cohorts or groups of people. So innately in a NAT, in a National Party member, we understand that there is a role for government to play in making sure those people get to the top of the list on occasion, because if you rely on the market to solve everything, which is a typical liberal ideology, then I think you do have parts of the community that start to feel left out, lost, and that then breeds anger and disenchantment.
Yeah.
So you do have to have a balance. So I don't think it's picking one over the other. It's actually saying when you're in government, when you've got the capacity to make some of these decisions, when you're making decisions on behalf of the taxpayer, let's make sure we don't create pockets of people that feel completely left out. That's hard to do. That's a hard balance.
Therein lies the work.
Some people just want to be seen, Ira. Some people just want to be seen and acknowledged.
Yeah.
It's not about money in some cases. It's actually about what are the policies that we can put in place that create that playing field where there's a degree of equity without, completely upturning what most people going about their day are doing and thinking.
Yeah, because I feel like that's what we've got away from. Like the overregulation is just ridiculous. So let's talk about some of those policies, because obviously you've been knocking on a lot of doors. Yeah. You've been hearing a lot of what. Tell me two things. What are people saying, and what sort of policies? And look, you don't have to be specific. I'm more interested just in what direction.
I think I think a back to basics is some of the things I'm hearing on the doors. Like we, if we're struggling to go and do our everyday or, you know, our weekly grocery shop as a family, we're not thinking about how we can contribute to our community, how we're going to pay for the school kids' uniforms or the sporting uniforms, those sorts of things. People, there are families that are really feeling that pinch. I think when I talk to local businesses, when I go into those small business trips in all of our communities, they're struggling because they see a little bit less money in everyone's pockets. And so they've got the added burden of people spending less, but also the overburden of regulations, how hard it is to manage and pay people with all the regulations around fair work. And it's not to say they don't want to be a good employer. It's just that to actually do the recruitment, to hold on, to actually, somebody was giving me a really specific example the other day in Mundaring around how many times they have to put their BAS statement in. All of the tax laws have changed over the last 4 to 5 years, and it's just become almost unmanageable for them. And yet they employ 40 people. And those people rely on that wage to actually pay their mortgage or their rent, and they feel it very keenly.
Yeah.
So going back and looking at some of that structural issue around why do we keep adding to that regulatory burden for small businesses and business instead of thinking how do we streamline it? The other side of what I get on a day-to-day when we're on the doors is that people who have managed to find their way through life in a reasonable way, they've got their house, they're really worried their kids aren't going to be able to afford to ever get into the housing market and have that security that they've got. And that's changed in my lifetime. I was lucky enough when I was in my 30s to buy a house. I'm still paying the mortgage, but and I'm in a position that's probably more privileged than many people in terms of a stable income, although not at the moment, but I'm not worried about that. Like there'll be opportunities there regardless of my future. But for a young person trying to pull together that mortgage or pay the rent while they're pulling together the mortgage for the deposit, there's more and more people that just say, we don't see an avenue to that home ownership. And that's very scary for me.
What can we do about that?
Oh, there's a whole raft of things. Some of it's, you know, you've got to work at it from the supply end and the demand end. There's no doubt that we've had a significant uptick in immigration, and this is, you know, in the last 3 years under the Labor government, we've seen significant immigration, and I have no issue with that. From a regional perspective, we need people that want to come and work in businesses and industries, but we need to decide which skills and where they should live, because that is most definitely in some parts of Australia putting pressure on the housing market. The other side of it is we need to actually encourage people with the right skill sets to come over and help us deal with the challenge. So we need plumbers and brickies and tradies, and we need to be training out. I'm not saying that's a put up the white flag and stop training our own, but at the moment there is a serious blockage. And so to get over that hump, we do need to keep bringing people in to make sure that we've got the capacity to overcome it.
Yeah, because I can tell you firsthand, so I've seen it. You can imagine, so my main trade is painter and decorator.
Yeah.
Started in 91. So you can imagine what I've seen change. And the problem with most of the immigrants that I see, I've got nothing against hiring these guys, right, but they just don't have the skills. So, like, you know, I back in the day used to do consultancy work for some of the bigger painting companies. I'd go there, work for a while, tell them how to improve things, blah, blah, blah. And I used to encourage them, oh, get an apprentice.
Yeah.
I was like, get an apprentice, right? You're training the guy up, you're looking after him. I used to tell them, right, morale is money, right? So if you can keep good morale. But here's the problem there. I saw, you know, the government making some statements about free TAFE, right? Not one single fucking journalist at that thing asked them how many spots are available right now. I know because one of my mates, his son tried to apply for an electrician's, right? Now, I can't remember the exact numbers, right? Me, I'll just make stuff up, but this is wrong, right? There was like about 600 applicants for 50 spots. Now, that shit is life-changing, right? And I'll tell you a little story. So when I left high school, a similar kind of thing happened. Now, really, what I should have done, right, was art. That's my passion, my love. some kind of graphic art. And look, I did end up doing it as a job for about 3 or 4 years, working for magazines and doing other things, right? But there was the same thing. There was 30 positions available, 500 people applied. So because there was nothing else for me to do, they said, oh, you might as well go do family trades, right? Yeah. So I went and became a painter and decorator. Now, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. I've made a lot of money being a painter. I've met a lot of cool people. But I fucking hate it.
Oh, there's right. nothing worse than doing something that you don't love every day.
Excuse my French. And don't worry, I've learnt to manage it and all the rest of it. But I just remember thinking at the start, right, like if this is working, I'm screwed. Now, it's not that I don't want to work. It's just that I want to do what I want to do and I don't want to be a painter. Now, the reason I told you that story is not to feel sorry for me, but one small moment in time, and I think about all those 500 young people, and people are saying to me, oh, the Gen Z, they're lazy. No, I don't think so. There was 500 guys, young guys, just out of high school in the northern suburbs that were willing to sign up for an apprenticeship, and this government said, sorry, can't help you.
It's a nice tagline, and it gets thrown in our face as the state opposition, previous state opposition, on a regular basis. You know, we dropped TAFE fees, we've got people going through, and I absolutely agree that we need to put more people through that TAFE system. It's an amazing opportunity, that pathway to being self-sufficient. You can travel wherever you want to do.
That's how you get those workers to build the houses that you need.
But within the TAFE system, you've actually got to then have the structure, which means you've got to have the qualified people who aren't on the job, on the tools, in the TAFE structure prepared to be able to do that. And that's always the challenge in Western Australia, because we've got a very strong mining industry. You know, a lot of those smaller businesses go through, take the apprentices on, and then they see them leave to go. I think without being too critical of our mining sector, because they do create amazing pathways and jobs and generate a lot of wealth for our state and nation, it is always the challenge, is that they will absorb the lure of the money for some of those younger. And it's not always the best outcome. A lot of them do come back having been on the mines. But for some people, it's an amazing opportunity, but it puts a lot of tension in that market when you're trying to train someone and then see them, particularly in ag, we see it. So a lot of ag, you know, they'll go through, they'll work, they've got great skills, and then off we go, we're onto the mines. And how we find that balance between industries in a state like Western Australia, which is very mining, oil and gas dependent and dominant, remains a challenge for every government of every stripe. But definitely creating more opportunities for people to go through the system is, and being able to do training where they need it. You can't, if you're, and this is me putting my regional hat on, if you're doing block release and you're forcing young kids that are going through their apprentice journey to then have to come to Perth and find accommodation, support themselves, those sorts of things, it is the difference between someone saying, I'm going to take an unskilled labouring job on the mines and finishing my apprenticeship. That is a reality, because it is the barriers for young people not being able to access that block release and where they're going to stay and how they're going to look after themselves, unless you've got a real supportive family or a bed to sleep in. Yeah.
The infrastructure's not there. I did this really interesting podcast recently with AI, all right, and if you got time, I recommend it. It was super interesting, man, because I asked it about all sorts of stuff, right, and political stuff. Now, here's what I find interesting about it, right? So I noticed that some of the big law firms are starting to use AI. Now, I started really paying attention when they started doing that, right, because these people don't mess around, right? They want the best information, they want it. And so then I started realizing, like, oh, it's got access to all the best info, right? So one of the things I asked on the last podcast, right, you know, it was like I led her a bit, don't worry, into, like, you know, the way humans live and, you know, the things that we do that are not so good for us. So I was like, sounds like living in the cities sounds like a good idea, but it's not really. What do you think about that? And what do you think is the best way for humans to live? And you know what she said? She said humans should start decentralizing populations and moving back to regional living. And I said to her, well, how do we get people to do that, right? Because in Australia, and you know what she said? She said build TAFEs and build hospitals in the country.
I mean... Decentralisation is basically the Nats mantra. Like, we live and breathe that. And not because, it's a really interesting conversation in the context of Bullwinkle and what we've done in this recent state election where we've said we want to come into the metropolitan area. But our focus has always traditionally been regional, and it's not to the detriment of the metropolitan area. It's because we think if the regions thrive, the whole state thrives.
Yes.
And we cannot continue to develop the way that we have over the last 50 years, where everyone clings to the coastal area of the Perth and the southwest areas, with increasing congestion issues, all of the problems with the ever decreasing block size, the lack of tree canopy, all of those issues, and the ever increasing challenge of linking it with the public transport and issues like that. Now, not against public transport, and you got to have it, but in a place like Western Australia with a Perth sprawl, that will always be a draw on the taxpayer's dollar. It is important infrastructure, but it's not going to generate you a dollar. Whereas I think if, like we did when we were in government in 2008 to 2016-17, we had that mantra of, if you invest in the infrastructure, the housing, the services, and some of the amenity in these towns, you will see people make decisions to actually relocate. Will they go to some of the most far-flung communities? Maybe not. But there's definitely capacity in the Geraldtons, the Kalgoorlies, the Northams, the Albanys, the Bunburys. If you go to the East Coast, where there's Bendigo and Ballarat and Wagga and places like that, they have major hospitals, major universities. We do not have that level of development in Western Australia, and are the poorer for it, I think. When you think about where the wealth of the nation is generated, we should have that kind of development, but you've got to do it on purpose. And I would then take a step backwards and say, we as a state have been very good at it in the past, but somewhere along the line, the economic rationalists took over. So guess what the debate was like when we were having the conversation around the Goldfields pipeline? You know,
yeah.
Like we had the gold mining industry out there. This is awesome. No water. Well, we can't have that. We're going to build the world's longest and biggest pipeline. And it's going to cost us a fortune, probably the entire of the state budget. And it was a doozy of a debate. You can go back and look at it.
Oh, yeah.
And the same thing with Sir Charles Court when they were looking at building the mining province and the Ord. Like, they were big and bold decisions to say, we need as a government to have a vision for what our whole state looks like, not just that next suburb in Perth. That's a very myopic way of looking at things.
Yeah.
The disconnect, and I kind of wanted to ask you about that, the disconnect between the city and the country. And it's like, I saw this meme and it was a picture of like, you know, the city and the country. And on the country bit, it said, you know, the people who live here, the city, want to tell the people who live here how to live. And I do see like a real disconnect. And look, just look at the votes. Like in the country, basically, there was only one party. A few other people got some votes, but you guys killed it. And the city, it was complete opposite. And this is what I'm saying about the disconnect. And I feel like, yeah, somehow along the way, like you said, the economic wizards or whatever they want to call themselves took over and policy became ideology.
Yeah, there's a degree of that. I think it's the way that the electoral laws also influence the outcome of the debate and who forms government. So if you reduce the number of seats in regional areas, you will get less people that have an understanding of the dynamic of what it means to live out there, to deliver services and infrastructure in those communities. The distinct areas like the Kimberley to the Gascoyne to the Wheatbelt to the Great Southern to the Goldfields. And that's been an ongoing and long-term plan from the Labor Party every time they've had the opportunity.
Four times in the last 4 years.
Every time they've had the opportunity to pursue that agenda, they've pursued it aggressively. And as a result, even at this last election, I think people saw the changes in the upper house, which is ultimately there will be far less people in that parliamentary house that understand regional communities. But even at a lower house level, the seats of Moore and Moore and North West Central became one. So we lost two seats where there were two members of parliament that represented the people from the Gascoyne and the Midwest. There is now one, and that's an enormous seat.
Can we flip that? Is there any way to flip that back, those laws?
You can absolutely. If you've got control of the parliament, you can go back in and make the changes you want to make. The reason that the Labor Party did it this time and they got it through pre-2008, it was because they had control of both houses of parliament and they used that power. As soon as they had it, it was in. So we, I think, as a state party, and I can't speak, I'm not sitting in their parliamentary team anymore, but I know the conversations have been had, that if we were in a position to go back and look at particularly the Legislative Council, there is a need for reform away from that single electorate model, because what you'll see over the next 4 years is a bunch of small minor parties, but also a reduction in, I think, a regional lens, which we needed. So those regions that existed before shouldn't have been the only decision-making factor, but in a state the size of Western Australia, you definitely need people that understand those areas, looking over the legislation in the House of Review and saying, that's not really going to work in the Kimberley. What do we need to do to make that work for those people? That's not going to work in the goldfields. How do we actually enhance this piece of legislation to make sure that we're not disenfranchising people that already feel disenfranchised? And that can equate to the hills. I talked to a lot of you, talked to me about what people are saying to me on the doors. I think in this eastern corridor, there are a lot of people that feel left right out. So we see a lot of development in the northern corridor, in the southern corridor, the Perth metropolitan area. We live in the hills. Sometimes it's just pretty hard to deliver a telecommunications or a road project or, you know, new infrastructure. And so we sort of just never quite get there. Well, that's not good enough.
My internet, Mia, between that white box and the room down the end. And, like, you know, people in Chidlow still don't have running water.
And I've been to a couple of meetings in Chidlow that is a choice of a government, and I can safely say that whilst it's been an ongoing issue, I was a previous water minister. I had many conversations with the Water Corporation and our government about prioritising areas that never get to the top of the list, because it's the right thing to do, not because Treasury says, "Well, that's too expensive. There's not that many people that live there. We're not going to do that." Well, sorry, but actually having a decent water service in the 21st century, when you've been given that undertaking, when you bought your property, it's different if you move into an area and the conditions are you have to be self-sufficient. Mm. These are communities that have had access to scheme water.
It's kind of hard to believe it's 2025, but yeah, anyway. Well, actually, one thing, sidetracking a little bit, I wanted to ask you about two things. So the Water Corp, we'll come back to that, but the last election, so obviously I wanted to ask you about that. So obviously the Libs got smashed, and look, it wasn't that too hard to predict, to be honest, but the margin was like shocking, you know. I meant the one before. So old mate Lisa and all those people, right? So when they got smashed, basically obliterated, you were kind of like, you know, they dropped the bomb and you were like the last person standing. And I always wondered, like, what did that feel like? Because even though you must have sort of had a bit of an idea it was coming, like, because you were sort of put into the position of being opposition leader with not really seeking it. And I just wonder if you could tell me a little bit about that time and what that was like.
Yeah, so I'd been leader of the Nats for 4 years by then, and I'd been a minister and the deputy leader of our party for 3-4 years prior to that. So, you know, I'd been in a leadership role in government and in opposition. And nobody joins the National Party thinking they're going to end up being the leader of the opposition. So you don't war game that. Mm. But towards that particular election, I had a couple of journalists start to say to me, "You could be the leader of the opposition after this next election." And I just looked at them flat in the face and said, "Mate, if that's the outcome that we're going to get, we are in a world of trouble." So I think that our team will hold their own, because we tend to suffer less swings when there are swings on. And that's a national trend with national party held seats. We tend not to lose our seats because of the way we manage them, the positive way we engage. We suffer less of a swing percentage-wise. And I said, "I don't want that outcome. not because I didn't want the job, but because I didn't want to see our parliament reduced to, you know, what it became. So if you want to know what was going through my head on that night, I was standing in my front yard in Northam, where I live, and I had all of the cameras facing me, like doing live cross throughout the night. All of my supporters behind me, because we'd won our seat. They're all having a champagne on the, you know, up the back in the veranda, and I'm just standing there. And I, if you go back and look at the footage, I reckon you'll be able to tell how I felt, which was shell shocked. And the question kept coming: do you want the job? Are you up for it? And I said, mate, this is not a question. Like, it's a, if this is the outcome, then in the National Party we're pretty practical and pragmatic. We'll just get on with the job. We will figure out how to do this in the new world order, which will be incredibly difficult for the Liberal Party, because that's not where they want to be. This is not something that we as the National Party have previously had infrastructure for. But I can promise you that I've got leadership experience. I've got a pretty practical team. We'll just get on with the job. This is, the West Australian people have spoken. This is how they've voted. We now need to make it work. And that's just the task. So you can't sit around and go, woe is me.
Yeah.
You probably want to have a bit of a drink before you get on with it. That's all I wanted to do was go and have a beer. But, you know, at that stage you were like, okay, right, well, let's get on with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did.
That's a pretty interesting response, because, like, really, when you think about it, it's probably never happened to anybody ever before.
The last, it was back in the 40s.
Was it? Oh.
And it was an anomaly.
Yeah.
The last time I'd have to go and look at my history books, but I think it was something that happened to the leader of the Liberal Party, and we became the opposition leader for a short, short period of time. So in the modern history of our party or the parliament, no, that has not happened. And an awkward relationship between us and the Libs, because they are used to being the major party. But I repeatedly said to people, we actually did enough to hold on to the seats that we won. Was it exceptional? No, but in a red tide at that election, we held on to more seats than they did. And so that, by virtue, is our role. And by virtue of the numbers, was our role. And so my job wasn't to go and smush everyone's face in it and say, oh, you did really badly, let's all just pile on. It was, okay, there's not very many of us anymore. We need to start working together to get an outcome. And I'm a person with a history of staunch independent thinking for our organisation, because I don't like the National Party getting lost in coalitions. We joined a party, we have our own platform, we have our own constitution, our members, and so whatever agreement we typically come to, we need to preserve that, otherwise we may as well join the Liberal Party.
Well, that was a question I had in my head to ask.
Sure.
Coalitions.
Yeah.
What do you think?
It always comes down to the leadership and how it is managed, because we are two different organisations. I think we've seen coalitions operate really well and deliver great outcomes for the state and also at a national level, and we've seen those that don't. And I think, and you would expect me to say nothing less, that when the National Party loses its identity in that relationship and just becomes part of the merged LNP or Liberal National Coalition, that we suffer for it. And there is differences in the way that the two parties approach problem solving, to different ways that we prioritise our policies and our membership. And whilst there's lots of things that we share, and they will be the things that we try to focus on, there does remain some differences. And so that's healthy. Healthy tension delivers a better conversation and a better outcome for the community. But in political terms, people say division is death. I don't think that. I actually have always thought we should be able to have a respectful conversation. As long as you're not playing each other off a break at every opportunity. And that comes back to the leadership of the organisation and how it gets managed.
Is there ever a temptation to do that, like play those two off against each other? Because I'll be honest, if I was you, I'd be tempted.
I think the temptation is always there, and there's frustrations that sit below the surface in every political party. You know, you've got people within the ranks and the rank and file of the organisation within your own parliamentary party that will have differing views on how things should be done. The role of a leader at any point in time is to take that all into consideration, but the greater good argument has to win. And greater good is how are we going to get an outcome for the people of Western Australia or, you know, the nation, and how are we going to maintain the faith with the people that put us in this role on the platform that we took to them. So what I never wanted to do as the leader of the National Party was form a coalition with a set of policies that our membership and our organisation had taken to an election and said, this is what we believe in, and then say the exact opposite because we formed a coalition. That's disingenuous. So compromise, always, yes. There is always compromise in any relationship. Healthy tension, always. And a respect for the fact that there are two organisations. I absolutely reject the commentary that's come out after this election that there needs to be a consideration of what they've done in Queensland with the LNP. Anybody that thinks that's a successful model, albeit the LNP are now in power, but they were in the wilderness for a very long time. I'm not sure that that model is actually the success story, and I'm happy to say that publicly, that people point to and say, we just need to merge and get on with it. It's not the outcome. I think that the people are close to the system would say that's how you get a decent outcome.
Yeah, it's interesting because, look, I don't know the answer, obviously, but I see that you guys, in some ways, you're not that far apart, but I like the idea of just standing on your own as well. Because one thing I've learned through life, Mia, I've made a few mistakes, and most of them was when I involved other people.
I think you've just got, being part of a team, a partnership, there's always going to be tension. And I could have jumped. Because I think we just focus on trying to get the outcome. I don't know. I mean, for me, as leader, and I can only speak to my experience, and I know Shane Love as the same, who's my deputy, is that you've got to be true to the organisation that you're a part of. We have a very proud 120-year history. We have members that turn up and they want to be a part of the National Party because they believe in our approach to politics and representation. I don't want to give that away, but I do want to be in government. I do want to be back in government. I know that that's the aim is to be where you have influence to deliver for your community. And you get that by sitting on the Treasury benches.
Yeah.
So you've got to find a way. There's got to be a pathway there without compromising yourself, because when you start doing that, it's a slippery slope.
Yeah. And look, it's funny, right, because 30, 40 years ago, if somebody said to you the Nationals could be in power, let's be honest, you would just say, mate, I don't know what you're smoking, but it must be good shit, right? But now, and look, I'm not saying it's going to happen and people will still argue pie in the sky and probably mount a very good argument, but I see the possibility that, well, you're already ahead of the Libs, now there's only one party to go.
I think I'd also say to that is that whether we are a major party or a future major party, in 2008, we won the balance of power in the state parliament with four members in the Legislative Assembly. So we don't need to aspire to be the pathway to actually being able to deliver on the policies and the things that are important to you is about how you make that system work so that you've got influence within it. Some people, and the two major parties will say, well, that means we've just got to have a majority and we have to be in charge and then we just get on with it. As a smaller organisation, we've always had to be more nimble, more flexible in terms of how we evolve over time. Our original purpose to represent farmers and settlers in the wheat belt, all those, you know, it was 1913, formed under a tree in Calabarran, not very far from where I grew up. The values of the organisation haven't changed. But how we present ourselves so that we've got influence in the parliament for the people and the state that we seek to work for has. So balance of power, royalties for regions 2008. We've been in coalition where we've formed a really good partnership. I look back and I know it was hard fought. My father was the state president of the party when he was negotiating with David Honey, who was the Liberal Party state president at the time, caught Cowan government. It was very successful for a long period of time. So there are different ways of getting to the outcome that you want. We have always been, I think, flexible in how we approach things. And you've got to. And if you ask any business person, they'll say the same thing. If you keep doing the same thing and expecting a different outcome, while the rules on the board change around you, and they have, electoral legislation, people's views, values, our state has grown, changed, all of those things change. You've got to be prepared to, without losing yourself, be flexible in that system.
Well, I love your answer because so two or three times in the last two or three questions, I've tried to draw you away from what you are and you keep pulling it back. And what I like about that is that you know how to stay in your lane, because I've just tried to throw it out there that you can beat the Labor Party, right? But you've given me a good answer. And I find that's what's interesting, that you guys seem to have a better objective view about just being what you are, because you said about staying in your lane. The other thing that you said about quality people, and if you go through and look at even the Libs on the election last weekend, the seats that they did win, they won with quality people.
Yeah, that's true. And that will always come through. There will always be a – and I've seen it with a number of the Labor MPs. You know, there's a personal vote there with the Labor vote that you can say got some of them over with a really strong majority, others more knife edge. And your comments around that, maybe one last example of where I think this illustrates how we approach things. When we won the balance of power in 2008, the traditional relationship between the Liberal and the National Party is that the two leaders are Premier and Deputy Premier. We never took the Deputy Premier role. Brendan Grylls was never the Deputy Premier of Western Australia. Now, that's something that, you know, if you're in a political world, to be able to say I was the Deputy Premier of the state, you know, might be a little shingle you want to hang on your wall at one stage. Comes with
a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. What was most important to us was that we got the policy embedded and that we could deliver for that out, that we could deliver that outcome. And so Brendan was the leader of the National Party, and that was a Brendan and a party decision. You know, in the art of negotiation about what's important in a balance of power relationship, the outcome of that discussion was we don't necessarily need the title or the money. We actually want to be able to deliver our policy. And that mentality sits within our organisation. And I go right back to the start where I said we are a party that is very pragmatic. You just want to get stuff done.
Well, I think that's a pretty good place to wrap it up, because I was going to say some other stuff after that, but I'm just going to wreck it. So you've summed
it up. I talk
a
lot too, sorry.
Well, so do I. And look, the reason we're doing this is because we like talking. But, yeah, I mean, actually, I will indulge myself with one specific thing. But, yeah, I think what you've done there is just summed up perfectly, because one of the things I'm always banging on about, Mia, is the ability to be objective, right? If everybody – and it's one thing I just hammer into my son, right? Be in the middle, look at both sides, weigh it all up. And I just think if more people could do that, we would get, like, way better outcomes.
Most people live in the centre of the political spectrum. That is where a majority of people are. And I think anybody that argues you need to go further to the right or further to the left or actually look at the world through that prism for every decision that you make is missing out on something. The biggest lessons I've learned in life are from people who have had an entirely different background upbringing to me, completely humbling in some cases, and have brought a point of view that has helped me sharpen my argument for the position that I've taken or reconsider it. And if you can do that in a way that keeps people feeling included without, you know, I disagree with you, back to your corner, never to be spoken to again, I think you bring more people with you. That's certainly something that I like. And it's a challenge. It's just like, how do we do this without losing people?
Yeah, it's something I've definitely learned. Like, I've had to work on my delivery, because it's funny, right? I feel like I've always been saying the same thing, but no one used to listen to me. Now people listen to me, and I think it's mainly just because I changed my delivery.
Yeah, that absolutely, how you say something, how you interact with people, whether they think that you're in it for yourself or for something else, and that takes time. That's not transactional politics is, I don't like transactional relationships, full stop.
Yeah.
Like, you do this for me, I'll do that for you. Ugh, no, because they don't last. They don't last. I want people to last when we're like at the bottom of the pile and we're at the top of the pile, and to keep coming back.
Yeah.
That's harder said than done.
That's a good point. Now, I want to talk about a specific thing. So, because if you win, obviously you're going to be in charge of this area. So one of the things that's close to my heart, right, is fishing. Now, that's a whole other podcast, but really what I want to talk about specifically is, let's say, Mundaring Weir. So I've actually got – now, when I say fishing, most of my fishing is what is catch and release, sports fishing, right? And I don't know what it is, but I did actually do a podcast with a lady, Jo Starling, and we talked about how fishing kind of saved our lives, right? Because both of us didn't have particularly good childhoods. And I just remember thinking, right, that if I could go anywhere and catch fish, I'll be okay. That's, you know, all I sort of remember. So I got into it. I did it as a job, you know, I was a professional angler for the best part of 10 or 15 years. Now, most of the fishing that I do, Mia, I have to fly over east because I'm not allowed to go down there to Mundaring Weir and catch trout, right? Now, there's a bit of a background to what happened, right? During the war, it was stocked in the early 20s, right? But during the war, all the water sources were taken under control. So now it comes under Water Corp. Now, around about early 2000s, because I was working at Fishing WA at the time, so I was quite involved in the industry and I sat on stocking committees and other stuff and sat on committees where we tried to get this, you know, overturned. And basically what they come from is they say, look, it's P1. They call that pristine one, right? Now, Mia,
I know it well. I'm smiling at you as you're talking.
We'll have a laugh about this, right? I was a bit younger and less experienced, right? Oh, I saw red, right? I was like, you dug a great big fucking hole in the ground and filled it up with water and you're telling me it's pristine? Now, obviously, I didn't understand what I was talking about. What they were talking about is drinking quality, right? Now, what people didn't realize is that if a tourist comes from China and he's got typhoid and he goes to the weir and he takes a leak and it goes in the water, the water's actually contaminated, right? Now, up until 2014, we treated our water below world standards, right? So I got a few journalists involved, long story, they built offtake towers, right? So now all the dams have all offtake towers, right? And Serpentine, like, it's fucking massive. It's a big dam. It's sitting there because desal's coming online. I think last year I checked the figures, about 17% of or 13% of the metro water came out. So basically what's happening is these dams are now sitting there, right, doing nothing, right? Now, to give an example, so one of the places I go over east is Hins Dam, which is on the Gold Coast, right? Mia, 500,000 unique visitors a year. Bushwalking, mountain biking, riding trails, fishing. Now, that dam in particular, right, is actually catch and release. But because it's catch and release lure only, right, and we could get into it, it's a whole nother podcast, but there's certain things that Water Corp will say, oh, we don't want people going there with bait, blah, 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 all this stuff, right? Well, they do it in Hins Dam. It's the drinking water for the Gold Coast, but because it's catch and release, right, mate, it's a trophy fishery.
Yeah.
So you know if you go there, like if I want to catch a trophy bass, I've got to fly over east. I'm not allowed to do it here. Yeah. So what I'm wondering is, you know, it comes under Water Corp, but this is just an example of a thing that's been taken away from us, right? And there's a sign down the road here in the national park that basically says fuck off, right? Excuse my friend, right? But no hunting, no fishing. And then, like, I couldn't tell you, my wife and I tried to figure out one day how many flights I've done, right? It's in the hundreds. I've been to New Zealand, but I'm not allowed to walk down there and fish. Now, the other thing is if you look at a map of the Scarp from Serpentine, but the strip mining, right? Now, they're just raping the bush. Right, they're allowed to do that, but I'm not allowed to go down there to catch trout. So how do we fix this? And like, Mia, I'm not too proud to say, like, I've shed tears over it.
Yeah, and you know, you'd be a silly politician to get in the middle of the wreck fish movement, because there are a lot of you and you're very passionate.
Most participated sport absolutely. In Australia.
So I did mention earlier that I was a previous water minister, which Water Corporation was a part of that portfolio, obviously, and it was a regular conversation around how we utilise the resources that we've got. And you're right, the original dam infrastructure and how we capture water for use has completely changed. So by far and away, desalination will become the major water source for the Perth Metropolitan and the scheme. And the dams are used basically for storage, so it's not runoff. And the argument, and this is a little while ago, I was minister back in 14, 15, 16. So I'm going off a memory, but their argument is the cleaner you can keep the water, the less contamination, the less cost there is in terms of having to
for them.
To process it, to deliver it, to the standards that they have to. Yeah, so the cost involved. It's the cost, because the cost ultimately gets handed back to the taxpayer, right? But I also think there's probably technologies and other examples, as you've talked about, that it shouldn't be a set and forget. And with Water Corporation, because they are quite a powerful organisation within government, they tend to hold a fair bit of sway with Treasury and also with decision makers. And I don't think it would be an unreasonable thing to ask a new member of your parliament to actually say, how about we have a look at this from a parliamentary committee perspective and actually start to look at it from all of the different economic aspects. So weigh up the water aspect with the rec aspect. I know the Shire of Mundaring has raised with me a number of times how they can use the catchment area for passive recreation more than they're allowed to. And I think you should never, as a minister or a government, just put things on a shelf and say never ever, because technology and regulatory regimes and communities change. And so it hasn't been looked at for a while, and I think you should ask.
Yeah, that's interesting that you say that.
It is a state issue, and I'm happy to help. If I'm in a position where I'm a local member from a Bullwinkle perspective, there will be a role for me, but the outcome of it will need to be driven through the state parliament.
Okay, that's interesting, because that was going to be one of my questions, because all I'll say is, like, when I came up against the Water Corp before, it was an awakening.
The grey hairs underneath the hair dye in here? Probably.
I realised, like, what you said about they have a lot of power, that's a very underlying statement. And I'd tell people, right, because don't worry, I've talked to a few other people as well, right, and I've said to them, however hard you think it's going to be, like, you've got no idea what you're up against. But so you don't think, because I would have thought, oh, federally, you'd be further up the food chain.
But it's not. So because Water Corporation is a state government body, the minister responsible is the Minister for Water. So all of the regulatory regimes, the funding, it's all state. So it sits fair and square with the state government of the day. And yes, Water Corporation is powerful, but they are an entity. And this is what I said at the meetings in Wooraloo and others, is just remember that the buck stops with the minister. They are the one shareholder in that organisation on behalf of the West Australian people. So whilst Water Corporation is a statutory corporation, which means they sit slightly separate to government, they are still a government entity. Their funding comes from the government. They'll never go broke. And they have to report, and they have agreements with Treasury and the minister. And the minister sits at the top of that tree. So there's no point blaming people within Water Corporation, because if the minister actually says, I want you to go and investigate this and come back to me with answers about how we might be able to change the policies, they are required with the Department of Water to do exactly that.
Okay, that's interesting, because I remember now back in early 2000s doing a fair bit of work with the minister at the time, even taking him fishing, because, you know, that's where you do deals on the golf course. And then the problem is you get all this work done, and then the new guy's in.
And I will say that we had a number of water ministers in our government. That was not ideal. I loved that portfolio. I had it for the last 3 years of our government. I had sport and recreation as well. So we were building the stadium. I was super dealing with water. You know, it is the most important resource we have in Western Australia. And you can use it for economic benefit, for environment, for sustainable economic development. And it depends on how you as the minister want to use that portfolio to assist the development of the state. And that means recreation. It means social. It means looking after and making sure we've got quality water resources for our communities.
Yeah, because I've looked right into it. Don't worry, I've got studies on that laptop there. I've done all the... And, like, Hins Dam's actually got a really good study that's been done by a proper government organisation. They tell you exactly everything you need to know. That's what we need to do first, a feasibility study. But, you know, all the stuff they come up with, like, you can manage, right? Like, so Hins Dam, right, it's electric only, okay, right? So no power boats. And immediately what happens is, you get rid of the dickhead factor. Right? Now, if you want to go down to Collie and water ski and be feral, go do your thing. But a lot of the people who do what I like doing, right, we're as close to like hippies as you can be. So we, you know, my little boat that I've got out there, it's fully electric. So it's silent. It goes in the water. It doesn't leave any pollution. The other thing is no bait, right? Lure and fly only. There's things you can do to manage. Like I would even say if I was on the committee, right, I would even say no jetties, right? A dirt boat ramp, that's all you need. So the less, because I know every pole you stick in the ground is going to be more work with those people. So if you keep it to a minimum, the other thing is what I really wanted to say, man, is the money. I can't even remember. Oh, actually, I do now. So Hins Dam's about $50 million a year.
That's huge.
That goes into the local economy.
So I think it's worth the conversation. And for the reasons and I said, one, is that everything changes.
Three dams in this seat.
What if you came to me as and I was member for Bullwinkle, what I would say is I'll help you in terms of plotting out the pathway to how you get the outcome. So what are the systems within the parliament? What are the systems in terms of getting to the minister? Where do we need to go? That is what a good local member should be able to do, or a member of parliament with an interest in what you're talking about. And preferably you want someone that's got some skin in the game, you know, so your local member's always going to be pretty passionate about it if they've got a constituent coming to you about it. But you shouldn't dissuade others from coming on board. Mm-hmm. Those conversations should be had. It should not be a set and forget. And so that's the role of working with people that understand the systems of government and parliament to try and get an outcome where you get a win for both sides.
Yeah, 100%. And that's where someone like you comes in because you've got so much experience. You know the lay.
Doesn't hurt. Definitely doesn't hurt to know the lay of the land and to challenge a few things along the way, because sometimes you get told very authoritatively by a government department, no. And then you're like, well, okay, I've been told I'm not allowed to do that, so I'll go off and I'll find something else to do. Well, actually, you are allowed to challenge those things.
It's heartbreaking. And you're like, state forest, there's another thing. You know, like we're the only state forest, because I do a bit of hunting these days by bow. I'm the only state forest in Australia, I'm not allowed to go in there, right? Now, we talk about Robin Hood, right? And we all laugh, oh, the king locked up the forest and the people weren't allowed to go in there, so the people poached. Whoa, hello.
Just a philosophical thing for me, I'm not a big fan of locking things up. So we've talked about, the marine park off the east coast as I've been going around during the state election. I think if you and the same thing's happened up in the Kimberley on the Fitzroy, and there'll be a lot of people that come at me for this, but I think if you manage things properly, that you should be able to do it sustainably. So if you have a managed fishery and a marine park or an area, if you're managing those things appropriately, then there's no reason to lock these things up and stop people from actually being able to do it. It means you have to have the resources to properly police it and to manage it. But I don't think we should be in the job of locking things up and keeping people's out, because you get perverse outcomes as well. So pest control in our national parks, very, very difficult. Similarly, up in the Fitzroy on the Fitzroy River, I'm not saying you dam the Fitzroy River, but there's definitely opportunities there to use some of that water without impacting the environment adversely for economic development. Now, I'll get a whole bunch of people coming at me straight away on that front. And most of the people that oppose to things like that, they come from overseas, over east. They have no idea what the actual lay of the land is. I've spent a lot of time up there.
Yeah.
So I'm not a lock it up, don't let anyone use it. We've got to find ways to be able to use our natural resources. It has to be done sustainably. You've got to look after the environment. But there's economic and social reasons to allow people to do some of these things. Practical,
it's
pragmatic.
It's common sense, Mia, but why isn't there more people like you?
Well, there's a few of them in our party. We'd like to have a few more.
Well, I think that's a good place to wrap it up. It's been an absolute pleasure. And like I said, thank you for coming onto my humble little podcast and for having a good chat. I always enjoy chatting with someone who likes talking. And wish you all the best coming up. I think you got a pretty good chance. I think you're going to surprise a lot of people, and I'm like, you know, I'll be pressing refresh when they're counting the votes. Like, it's a week later, I'm still doing that. But it'll be super interesting to see how you go.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I think you guys will go really well.
We'll see. We never count our chickens. You just got to do the work. But I appreciate the chat. It was a lovely way to spend a Saturday morning. Intense chemistry, they expect the list when we sound the list. Western supremacy, intense chemistry. Best be aware. Western supremacy, supremacy. Intense chemistry, Western supremacy, intense chemistry. Best be aware, new blood starting to drip.